From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Matt Holzman, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the Los Angeles Times fights to be the newspaper of record in our company town. Plus, what are the lessons of the epic battle over the Star Wars fan movie Fanboys? But first, it's the news from Hollywood and beyond. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW. Almost 6 years after he was elected governor and after 6 years of getting pummeled by other states with production tax credits, former Hollywood denizen Arnold Schwarzenegger finally got California on the bandwagon. There were $100 million in credits per year for 5 years as part of the state budget package passed on February 19th. The city of Los Angeles is also looking into ways to become more Hollywood-friendly, including potentially hiring a film czar and lowering the price of Botox. Elsewhere, the financial upheaval continues to rattle Hollywood. The LA Times reports that Sony Pictures plans to cut about 300 jobs, or 4% of its workforce, amid slumping DVD sales. The move follows a massive layoff of 8,000 full-time and 8,000 part-time workers announced by the studio's corporate parent at the end of last year. In related news, the studios have cut $20 million from their trade association's budget. The cutback at the MPAA will force staff and program layoffs, as well as a reduction of the PG-13 rating to PG-12. Meanwhile, while we don't normally report on the doings of Hollywood's mid-level executives, we feel compelled to congratulate Karen Glass on her promotion to Vice President of Development at Sony Pictures Television. Glass, sister of This American Life host Ira Glass, will handle development and production in New York for Sony alternative series, including network, cable, and first-run syndication. Upcoming projects include The Matt Holzman Show, starring me! Finally, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino have sued over the use of their likenesses in the film Righteous Kill. According to the New York Post, the actors have filed a $10 million lawsuit against the film's distributor and Tutomo Watches because images from the film's poster were used in ads for the pricey timepieces. While Pacino wore a Tutomo watch in the movie in a product placement deal, he and De Niro argue that the deal did not include any off-screen promotion. Tutomo representatives did not return my calls about why they would even want to be associated with a movie the New York Times called inert. And that's the news from Hollywood and beyond. Coming up later in the show, Luke, I am your production executive. But next, the LA Times brings back Company Town. Last week, the Los Angeles Times announced that they're putting together a new arts and entertainment department to, quote, strengthen its coverage of the media business, unquote. They'll be combining the efforts of 50 reporters from the calendar and business sections and bring back the Company Town feature to the business section Monday through Friday and eventually online at latimes.com/companytown. Craig Turner will leave his role as the Times weekend editor to become arts and entertainment editor, and Sally Hoffmeister leaves her post as Times business editor to take over as the new assistant managing editor of arts and entertainment. With tons of layoffs at the Times, the web becoming the go-to spot for showbiz gossip, and an industry that has always been indifferent at best to their hometown newspaper, Sally and the LA Times have a rough road ahead of them. You know, one of the complaints about the Times is that, in fact, it's the paper of the company town, and yet it hasn't done a great job in the past of covering the stories, of especially getting the big breaking stories that it seems like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal seems to beat you to that story. Rather than making a big announcement or adding resources or doing anything else, wouldn't it make sense just to do the reportage and get known as the paper, the go-to paper for those big breaking stories?
Well, I challenge you to give me examples of the stories we have not broken.
For instance, let's even talk about Pelicano. It seems like the New York Times had kind of the beat on that story, and that the Times
was
following.
They had the wrong beat on that story.
So you're saying that they just got the story wrong?
Well, I think they were they had a story, certainly. They made the story a big sensation, and then the story fizzled, actually.
So you're saying that you guys do have the reportage.
And that's not – and that – I'm just
– Go ahead.
Let me
sure.
finish one thought on that, Pelicano. That would probably not come under the purview of either the business section or the calendar section that was done out of Metro.
Well, then maybe I stand a little corrected. Maybe it isn't that you guys haven't done the reportage, but maybe there's been a lack of understanding of what the people in the industry are interested in, because that story – I mean, certainly that story ended up being a lot of nothing, but certainly at the beginning when people were wondering if the biggest names in show business were going to be indicted, that was the story that everybody in Hollywood was talking about. That to me is not a Metro story. It was a entertainment story.
You could slice it either way. I mean, that's kind of one of the challenges that we faced the papers, that we have entertainment reporters across all of the sections. And we are now consolidating them just for that reason. One, because we do have limited resources, and two, because we want to more effectively leverage those resources to break news.
Now, obviously, Variety and The Hollywood Reporter are not doing, you know, gangbusters these days. And it does sound like some of the things you're planning on doing is hoping to attract some of the people who read the trades, doing charts and data and things like that. Have I got that right?
Sure. I would say that's probably correct. Certainly, we can't be a trade publication for the industry. We just don't have enough newsprint or resources for that. But you know, we'll try to go down the middle, you know, do some things that would attract readers who are in the industry as well as the general public.
One of the problems that you're obviously going to face, that the trades and everyone else has faced, is that this is an industry that loves gossip, and bloggers aren't weighed down by all those, you know, troublesome journalistic ethics that we as
– I know. It's a killer, isn't it?
Right. So what do you do about that? I mean
– That's a hard one. We just have to – move more quickly. I think lots of times we strangle ourselves with our own rules. For instance, I think we could say we are the first newspaper who broke the story about Peter Chernin leaving News Corp. We were running this down on a Friday night and had a tip that there was going to be a board meeting the following Tuesday to discuss this, but that Peter had decided to leave. We had it from one source. Now, that's not enough generally in our rule book to put it out in print.
Right.
And so we kind of faced this conundrum of what can we write? We didn't write anything that Friday night, even though this drumbeat has been going on in Hollywood for weeks and weeks, if not, you know, months and probably a year about whether Peter would re-up or go. And we'd been hearing it. We'd done a story about a week earlier or 2 weeks earlier about this idea that Rupert Murdoch had come out to the studio kind of reinserting himself in the process to bone up on Peter's job because he planned to do it himself if Peter should leave. We did a story kind of setting it up because everything we were hearing was that Peter was going to leave. But that Friday night, we didn't figure out how to put that on a blog. And on Monday morning, Nikki Fink put up on her blog a couple sentences about, I just got a tip that there is a board meeting on Tuesday and Peter's leaving. We scrambled and we put something together very quickly and we actually confirmed it. She based hers on a phone call. You know, that's – would we put something on the website, you know, based on a phone call, you know, if we heard that Steve Jobs was dead – I'm sorry, Steve, or that he was sick
God forbid.
He was going to the hospital? No, we would never take that kind of risk with someone's – life like that.
Okay, well, let me stop you for a second now. You would have to admit that Hollywood is a town of rumors.
Yes, it is. That's why you have to be very careful.
But could you not have a column that could be the rumors column and say, we have this from one source, and that
right.
way people like Nikki don't steal your thunder?
We talked about that. In fact, I had this idea for a little column called Rumor Fact Innuendo and putting We might still do something like that just because I was frustrated that we couldn't get a lot of what we heard in – we couldn't get credit for hearing it, knowing it first. And so we're grappling with that. But actually we huddled and, you know, we – as I say, we get kind of verklempt and our first instinct is, oh, we don't have enough to write it. But sometimes we do have enough.
Then Nikki gets the kudos for breaking the story.
Told
you. Yeah, told you, exactly. And then people are more likely to go to her.
She's the go-to person.
Right.
Yes, and it's a snowball effect. You're absolutely right. Right.
And this is obviously not a problem that you're facing, and not certainly just in the business. It's everywhere in the newspaper business. The problem, of course, is that in Hollywood, more than probably any other business, it really is a town that runs on rumor.
Right. No, you put your finger on it. And the other phenomenon is no one remembers or cares that she's wrong a lot of the time.
Yeah, but they would remember if you were because it's in a newspaper.
Right, exactly. Right. And right. They would say, oh, the LA Times can never get it right. You know, so we have to be careful, but we also have to be faster off the mark and, you know, sometimes take a few risks that we will be wrong.
What is one of the biggest problems that the LA Times faces in terms of people wanting to go to you as opposed to the New York Times to break stories?
We've had this problem forever. And we know, you know, I won't name names, actually. I won't do it. But companies and individuals love to see their pieces in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It gives them a feeling of credibility. And companies certainly love to leak stories to the Wall Street Journal because it speaks right to investors and right to Wall Street. And they like to see the stock move or reassure investors. You know, there's some messaging that goes on. And, I mean, this has been going on for years. Certainly I felt it as a reporter. It was very hard to get scoops on certain types of stories because they were hand-fed to the journal. The New York Times, a similar phenomenon goes on there. And lots of the media is based in New York, so they like to appear in those pages. The LA Times is the local paper that the industry kind of loves to hate. And on those big stories especially, you know, they just like the New York press. They like to be seen in those papers.
You get it. You obviously get it. And that's great. That's half the battle. Now, what do we do about it? Because I know I would rather read these stories in the LA Times.
We have some dogged reporters. Claudia Eller, I'm sure you know her name, and she never lets that kind of thing escape the attention of a PR person at a company. You betcha she calls and gripes when she is scooped and it's a handout. You know, so we have to use our relationships, of course, and be better at what we do, which, you know, we have to be better reporters on the ground and in everybody's business and write what we know and make it hard on them to avoid us.
Sally Hoffmeister is the new assistant managing editor of arts and entertainment for the Los Angeles Times. On March 3rd, the Times brought back their company town section to anchor enhanced coverage of the business of Hollywood. Sally, I wish you the best of luck, and I'll be reading. Thank you for joining us on The Business.
Thank you so much for having us.
For me and my ilk, the Star Wars theme is a light-speed jump back to one of the happiest moments of our then-young lives. But for some people, Star Wars isn't yesterday, it's part of every day. They are the fanboys. In 1998, a geeked-out guy, those are his words, named Ernie Klein, wrote a heartfelt comedy about a group of fanboys who go on a road trip to George Lucas Skywalker Ranch. Their mission? Steal a copy of the new Star Wars movie so their friend can see it before he dies of cancer. Klein thought he'd cobble together the movie himself before the Star Wars prequel came out the following year. But Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, came and went. About the time the last Star Wars prequel came out in 2005, the newly formed Weinstein Company bought the script with a first-time director attached. Online, the fanboys rejoiced.
The Weinstein Company makes best decision of their early history, picks up Ernie Klein's fanboys,
screamed Harry Knowles on Ain't It Cool News.
Fanboys at Weinstein Company, forces with a Star Wars fan movie,
said another site. About 6 months later, filming on this homage to the fanboy began in Albuquerque. To make the thing work with just a $4 million budget, director Kyle Newman, a huge Star Wars fan himself, reached out to other fanboys.
And they became part of our production team and our family. They really helped, you know, make the film come to life, and it wouldn't have happened without them.
Jess Coffer was part of that family.
There was an Ewok costume that was made by my friend Ken and his wife Melanie, and there's like a treasure room that he's got with all this stuff being displayed. We almost put everything in that room, including like there was an R2-D2 life-size, a Gonk droid, C-3PO, life-size Darth Vader. We put all this stuff in this set.
Jess and his friend Ken Van Liesel are members of the Dewback Ridge Squad of the 501st Legion, a New Mexico chapter of a Star Wars fan group. On their website, they're dressed in the stormtrooper armor of Vader's Fist, the 501st Legion. Clearly, for fanboys like them, being on set was almost too good to be true.
End of the day wrapped up with us getting to meet Billy Dee Williams, which was incredible. He's the guy who played Lando Calrissian in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
Harvey Weinstein, the stormtrooper of indie film, loved the idea of fanboys and had helped Kyle Newman land Lando.
Harvey was very hands-on.
Dana Brunetti is one of the film's producers and Kevin Spacey's producing partner. Spacey's company brought the project to the Weinstein Company.
Him working in conjunction with Kevin, that was crucial in getting like William Shatner and Carrie Fisher and Billy Dee Williams and a lot of the other their cameos that we had in there. So he was hands-on a lot.
The fanboy set had a let's-put-on-a-show feeling with actors, crew, and fans all united towards a common, wonderfully geeky purpose. But while this all might have been a dream come true for fanboys, sources told me it was turning into a bit of a nightmare for Weinstein. Dailies coming back from the set were not looking good. The first-time director didn't seem to have a good sense about things like camera choreography, and the jokes were falling flat. But producer Dana Brunetti says that when they finally did a test screening, everyone seemed psyched.
I remember talking to Harvey afterwards, and they came out and they said, "Do you want to see what the results are?" And he's like, "I don't care what the results are. I love the movies. Like, that's one of the best experiences I've had in a movie in a while." And, you know, it was the first test screening we had. It's like, how awesome is this?
But Harvey Weinstein, like most people in Hollywood, talks a good game. No one was surprised when reshoots came up. Most movies have reshoots, and Fanboys was not going to be an exception.
We were running and gutting in Albuquerque when we were shooting this with no money. Now they're going to throw more money at it. They really believe in the film.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely a good thing.
Everyone agreed that the first 15 minutes of the movie were slow, and Weinstein execs had other concerns. Discussions about what to do next delayed production, and meanwhile, other factors started to come into play. Director Kyle Newman.
The names that I'd cast in the movie were suddenly becoming bigger names in the entertainment industry, like Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel and Dan Fogler and Kristen Bell. So these people's careers started to take off, and then it was, all right, let's turn this more into a bigger comedy than, you know, the small kind of film we made.
Meanwhile, a new kind of comedy like Judd Apatow's 40-Year-Old Virgin and Superbad were making big money at the box office. And since they were planning on doing some reshoots anyway, the folks at Weinstein thought, why not take this movie, pump up the funny, and cut out the cancer?
Quite honestly, when I first heard that, I was like, this is a joke. I'm being punked.
Producer Dana Brunetti.
I mean, it's the catalyst of the story. It takes all the heart away from the movie, and that's when the battle really started.
The fight over fanboys. After a short break, you're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman. In 2006, Kyle Newman directed an homage to hardcore Star Wars fans called Fanboys. It's the story of a group of fans who try to steal a copy of Star Wars One, The Phantom Menace, before it comes out, so one of their friends can see it before he dies of cancer. But execs at the Weinstein Company, which owned the project, felt the first-time director didn't know how to fix his own movie. Harvey Weinstein himself seemed unclear about what to do. After all, comedy was not his forte, and a sweet homage to sci-fi geeks was really out of his area of expertise. He didn't have a clue about fanboy culture. To top it all off, the Weinstein Company was rumored to be headed for money problems, and I think the promise of a super bad-sized payday seemed too good to pass up. So they decided to go, as they say in Hollywood parlance, in another direction. Producer Dana Brunetti.
They decided to bring in, to remove the producers, myself included, and the other two producers, and the director, and have Steve Brill and Shauna Robertson and basically the Apatow gang come in.
Shauna Robertson was producer of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Superbad. Brill directed a couple of Adam Sandler comedies. Kyle Newman was put in a difficult position in just his first time out as a director.
I'd talked to him and I met him.
Yeah.
And the actors had met him as well.
All right, so everybody's cool.
No. No.
Okay, tell me about
No, I don't
that.
Think the actors were very comfortable with what the pages were or the change in scenario, but it was something they were contractually obligated to do.
Fanboys was filled with Star Wars clips and music, and they'd even been allowed to shoot at Skywalker Ranch. In exchange, Lucas demanded final cut and a PG-13 rating. Producer Dana Brunetti used his powerful partner, Kevin Spacey, and the people at Lucas to get at least some of what they wanted.
The agreement that we were able to get to with Harvey was, you know what, let's shoot both versions and just see if we can amp it up a bit. We'll shoot the cancer version and the non-cancer version. It literally was, they were called that. And I realized when I was on set that when the cancer version was being shot, it was one take. And the non-cancer version was being shot, it was multiple takes. And it was being well covered. And that hit a nerve with me, and so I said something. And then that's when I realized that I wasn't even supposed to be there.
Inexplicably, given his rumored financial problems, Weinstein ended up spending a reported $2 million on reshoots and new material, half again as much as the original budget. Through it all, fanboys like Jess Coffer of the 501st Legion Star Wars fan group were closely following the developments, and they were not liking what they were hearing.
They're going in and cutting something up that shouldn't be cut up. Maybe putting a different smile on the Mona Lisa. It's just not going to work.
Director Kyle Newman.
I felt like some of the things being suggested were very they were antagonistic towards our fan base.
And what's an example of that?
Starting the movie with a crawl that would maybe say, fanboys, a term for losers who live in their mom's basement who can never get laid.
Fan protest sites popped up all over the web, dubbing Harvey Weinstein Darth Weinstein and pasting his face in Vader's trademarked outfit. Jess Coffer.
I'd sure hate to be in his spot, being nailed like that by tens of thousands of fans.
For his part, director Kyle Newman was fighting the changes as best he could with the limited power of a first-time director.
I just looked at it very objectively and said, well, okay, so they did it. Now what can I do if this comes back to me to make this the best version possible? Now I have additional footage at my disposal.
So. At any point did you think, wow, this is really headed in a direction that I'm not comfortable with, I'm going to take my name off the film and walk away?
The entire time.
But it seems to me that neither Kyle, Kevin Spacey, nor the people at Lucas really pushed as hard as they might have. Producer Dana Brunetti.
If I pulled the nuclear option there, the film would have gone to DVD and would have never been released. It is a nuclear war. You fire the first nuclear weapon, you think one's not going to come back at you?
The web chatter was making negotiations more complicated. Some people actually thought the Weinstein Company was creating the internet dust-up to promote the film, and Harvey thought that Dana and Kyle were sitting in front of their PCs personally posting every Darth Weinstein comment. And then some really suspicious posts started to appear.
Criticizing the fan base and calling them fanatical and crazy, like the religious right wing of America. That was a quote.
You will see your precious Star Wars homage movie has been made and has been preserved. You will see. And then you should apologize to Darth Weinstein.
When some clever fanboy figured out that the real author of these posts was none other than replacement director Stephen Brill, an online war of words ensued. Here's one fan's message to Brill.
You suck for recutting, fanboys. You really do.
And here's Brill's response.
You suck for emailing me your ish-hole whining. You are gonna like fanboys better because of me, and then you can kiss my ass.
Online protest reached a fever pitch. Fanboys threatened to boycott all of the Weinstein Company's movies, though I don't think that was all that effective. After all, how many of these guys were going to see The Reader anyway? But the real kicker was that the new version of Fanboys wasn't testing any better than the original film, and it was certainly no Superbad. So in a very un-Vader-like move, Darth Weinstein relented. Dana Brunetti says he gave Kyle Newman a few days to try to piece back some semblance of his original movie. Harvey was done being the bad guy.
It was kind of funny because when he made the agreement for Kyle and I to go back into editing, and he's like, all right, can we stop all this internet stuff now? And it was kind of like, I think he thought I had a switch that I could just turn off and then it would just all go away.
At the last Comic-Con in July, Kevin Spacey told an audience, I am enormously grateful to Jedi Knight Harvey Weinstein for having allowed us to restore Fanboys to its original story, no doubt reading a script written by Harvey himself. Producer Dana Brunetti and director Kyle Newman hold themselves up in an editing room with their notes and reps from the Weinstein Company.
Was that ugly in there?
On those 4 days?
Yeah.
No, not at all. It was very collaborative and productive, and it was actually the best part of the and the most collaborative between all entities and through the whole process were those 4 days.
So the version of Fanboys that was finally released on February 6th would be a Kyle Newman Fanboy-approved version. But that was not going to be enough to bring huge numbers of Fanboys to the theaters. Though the movie has been expanding to more markets since it was released, box office has been underwhelming. The ad budget was minuscule, but even a lot of the hardcore fans who had been following the film's progress online stayed away. Director Kyle Newman.
We changed our release date 7 times, so there was a cry wolf aspect to it where a lot of people were like, is it really coming out? This was up a week beforehand. Like, we really don't want to talk about it again because you've told us it was coming out before. We'll see it when we believe it.
However it ends up doing in theaters, you can bet that Fanboys will do big business on DVD if it's not pirated to death before then. A Google search for illegal copies came back with almost 500,000 results. After all this, there's a feeling that the movie probably can't be that good, and either way, I'm guessing that web-savvy fanboys don't like the idea of putting money in Darth Weinstein's pocket. But they should grow up a little. Movies are a collaborative medium, and movie making is big business. It's a lot messier than the black-and-white world of, say, Star Wars. And that's The Business. Next week, we're excited to welcome our new host, Kim Masters. I'm Matt Holzman, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. And you can comment and engage with other listeners there as well. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Matt Holzman, and we'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.